Okay, looks like everybody is on board. This is 20-2160 United States versus Vigil, and Mr. Fuchs for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, I'd like to talk to you about time. A temporal proximity between a statement and the event giving rise to the statement are the touchstones of admissibility pursuant to 8031 and 8032. This is the foundation of both of those exceptions to the hearsay rule, and quite frankly, it's the most important part of those rules, as it ensures the trustworthiness of the statement. In this case,
let me ask you a question.
Sure.
It's less a question than a request that you make distinctions during your argument. The temporal requirement for present sense and impression may not be exactly the same time or even close to the same time as the temporal requirement for an excited utterance. So if you speak of both exceptions at the same time, I think it will confuse the issue. So sure. if you would focus on that, please.
I could do that, Your Honor. And I think that Your Honor's right. The issues are close, but they are slightly different. But when we starting first with 8031, rule 8031 states that a present sense impression is a statement describing or explaining an event or condition made while or immediately after the declarant perceived it. Again, the time requirement is a strict requirement. This is the factor which assures the trustworthiness of the statement, and that comes from U.S. versus Green. When it is clear that a description did not immediately follow the described event, admission is not warranted. And in this case, the government did not show that the AW statement immediately followed the described events. There were several time frames which were at issue where the statement arguably could have been related to a specific event. There was the time when the defendant and, or excuse me, Mr. Vigil and AW went to bed. 30 minutes later, I believe, Consuelo Ward checked on them and saw nothing happening. There was a period of time after that upon which AW got up, went into the family room with her mom. Mr. V. Hill followed shortly after. Then AW returned to bed, and Mr. V. Hill followed her about, I think it was 10 minutes afterwards. And then there was the last incident, which was described by Consuelo Ward. But I need to be clear on something here, and that is that the statements that we're concerned about are not the statements of what Consuelo Ward said she saw. She didn't see any nefarious act occurring. The statements that are at issue are those of AW made later in the vehicle. And it is the position of the defense and of Mr. Vigil that the description that she gave of those events or alleged events could not have reasonably occurred in that time period. CW got into bed. She was in bed for approximately three minutes. It's not clear if she was able to fall asleep during that time, but ostensibly, arguably, she was awake. And when you consider the nature of the allegations contained in AW's statement, it's simply not reasonable to believe that that's when the event occurred. And more to the point, AW never stated when the events occurred either. We have a situation where in that 3 minute period, AW stated that the following things happened. That
counsel, it feels like, you know, I got the same impression when I was reading your brief. It feels like you're challenging the sufficiency of the evidence. You're basically saying this could not have happened as the government says it happened.
Well, two things to that, Your Honor. One, the government has to establish when the event occurred. That is a preliminary question that has to be answered. In a situation with hearsay, it's not uncommon that the statement that is at issue is also a statement regarding the actual incident at issue in the case itself. So to go with the government's argument, first off, it would the exception would swallow the rule. In other words, no one would ever be able to challenge those 8031 or 8032 statements simply because they related to the actual incident. But also the fact remains, and I think Rule 104 states this as well, that when it comes to preliminary questions, the court has to make a decision as to what a reasonable jury could find. They don't take into account the credibility of the statement or of the witness providing the statement, but there has to be some preliminary finding, and we don't want to get into a situation where the exception ends up swallowing the rule. And in this case, it wasn't reasonable as a matter of law for the jury to find that this could have occurred, where the child said that Mr. Vigil attempted to anally penetrate her twice, that Mr. Vigil attempted to, I believe it was, lick her cookie. For these things to happen while Consuelo War is sleeping or right next to them and did not testify to any of this, and she didn't hear anything. AW testified or stated that in her statement that she said, please, please stop. Consuelo Ward never heard any of that. The only thing that Consuelo Ward heard was a gasp, and it's unclear what that gasp was related to. She said it was in pain. It could have been the child was.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you again, too, and I guess I should clarify. I think we're at a plain error standard on this, aren't we? Because you didn't object. You did object to the admission of the statements, but your objection at trial was not at all based on the fact that there was no evidence or record as to the exact time of the events. Your objection, as I understood it, was as to essentially the witness's, Cordova's, reliability.
I hear what Your Honor is saying.
And she was relaying the statement that AW made.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the argument now is not, I want to stress, it's not based on CW's credibility. That's not an issue before the court.
Right, but, so we do, I mean, if we apply a plain error standard, that's pretty hard. I mean, this is a factual error, essentially, you're alleging here. It's pretty hard to overcome.
It can be. Two things on that. First, I don't think we're at a plain error standard. I think that the issue is properly preserved, and we've cited a couple of cases for Your Honors to consider: United States versus EF, United States versus Tisdale, and United States versus Harrison. And some of the language in Harrison I thought was really helpful and helped me kind of frame this issue when looking at it, because I suspected this might be a concern for Your Honors. But the legal underpinning of the necessity for specificity when making an objection is so that the court is not deprived of the opportunity to correct its action because it doesn't really know what the issue is. That's the underpinning of it. And when I think about whether the issue was preserved, and when I think about those cases, I think about three reasons why we require that specificity. One, I already stated, so the district court can adequately respond. Two, fairness to the government, so the government can respond to the issues. And three, so that this court that I'm before right now has the ability to adequately address issues that have been brought before the district court. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I think that all three of those kinds of concerns are met. Judge Vasquez very diligently addressed the time frame in her order. Mr. Daback, in his briefs, filed a very argued or laid out the facts regarding that issue very, very clearly and in detail. We, as the defendant, Mr. Vigil, is not relying on anything that isn't already on the record before this court. So I don't think we get to a plain error standard. I think that the issue was properly preserved at the lower court. But to your Honor's concern, regarding plain error, and you know this is kind of rote, but you obviously there has to be shown that there is an error, that the error was clear, and we believe the error was clear in this case. The admission of the statements without actually establishing when the actual incident occurred violates the very clear rules of evidence and also other numerous decisions by this court as well. When we move on to the third prong, and It's the Mr. Vigil's responsibility and my responsibility to show that there's a reasonable probability, a reasonable probability that without the error, the result of the proceeding would have been different. And in this
case, are we stuck though in this for purposes of the appeal with basically a time frame of around 20 minutes between the incident and the statements? And wouldn't that suffice under both present sense impression 8031 and 8032? Isn't that a close enough proximity to satisfy those evidentiary provisions under our case law?
I think it's possible. But the issue is slightly, as we see it, is slightly different from that. The issue is, when did the incident occur? And so the issue that we have before this court is whether a reasonable jury could have believed that the incident occurred at that 3-minute interval in the bed in between the time that CW came to bed and the time that they decided to leave. And we would submit that it clearly is not. And there's some support for that by the fact that the jury found Mr. Vigil not guilty of count one. So clearly they believe that there's a possibility that it didn't happen. So when we talk about whether there's a reasonable possibility, whether the result of the error, without the error, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Well, we think there's very clear evidence of that. And by looking at the fact that the jury acquitted Mr. Vigil of count one, but also because the government's entire case relied on two things. One, those statements, which were incredibly prejudicial, and two, the DNA evidence. And the DNA evidence, quite frankly, was all over the place. There was evidence of DNA on AW, which is quite frankly not entirely surprising, because one, she was in his bed with him, and two, more importantly, she used his dirty towel to dry off that night. So the DNA evidence is questionable. And on top of that, adding a kind of more intrigue to this whole issue is that there were several types of DNA done. And the DNA showed that there were different individuals or other individuals' DNA on AW not belonging to that DNA, not being Mr. Vigil's. And then we got into the probabilistic genotyping, which I believe showed four different individuals' DNA on AW. So when we talk about going back to Judge Moritz's question about plain error and whether or not there's a reasonable probability that the result would have been different, we have a real concern there because of the uncertainty of the DNA evidence. Moving on, when we're talking about plain error and we talk about whether it affects the integrity or the credibility of the judicial process, I think it's important to note that, first off, hearsay evidence is disfavored. And more importantly, AW never testified in this case. The defense never had the opportunity to cross-examine her, to get to the bottom of what these statements were about. And this is a real concern, especially when you consider there was other testimony from Jessica Trujillo, who stated that AW told her that CW told AW what to tell the doctor when she got there. So when we talk about the credibility, the reliability and the integrity of the judicial process, alarm bells, quite frankly, should go off, because the defense never got to cross-examine AW, and because the DNA evidence was just so was so wonky, for lack of a better word. But going back to 8031, we believe that it was not reasonable for the court that the court committed abuse of discretion, because it was not reasonable to believe that what AW stated happened could have happened in that short of a time. Moving on to 8032 and to what Judge Hartz was mentioning before, the issue was a little bit different. Obviously, 8032 requires three things: a startling event, a statement made while under the stress of the event's excitement, and then a nexus between the event and the statement itself. Again, the temporal proximity is important, but it is slightly different. It's the government's burden to show that the declarant was still under the stress of the event, the continuing stress of the event. And in this case, the government wasn't able to prove that, because the testimony was that AW when Consuelo Ward got AW to leave, they're getting ready to leave, AW turned to Mr. V. Hill and referred to him with a term of endearment. Goodbye. Goodbye, Uncle Kevin. And then she gave him a hug. I see my time is up. If I could finish that answer.
Go ahead and finish your argument on this point.
Thank you, Your Honor. So when we talk about whether or not there was a showing of continuous stress from the event, well, the stress is obviously wasn't there immediately after. There was a break in the stress. The child was, as I stated, referred to Mr. V. Hill by a term of endearment. She gave him a hug. She gave Mr. V. Hill's unfortunately deceased daughter, Tabitha, a hug, and then left. So we don't have that continuous state of excitement related to or stress that's related to the event that 8032 requires. I understand that there was some other evidence posited by the government that perhaps that is not what occurred, but in a situation, or excuse me, that AW was crying when she left. But when the evidence is controverted as it is here, the court should look at whether the government has carried its burdens by a preponderance of the evidence. And we would assert, Your Honor, that they have not.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from the government. Mr. Naback.
May it please the court and good morning. My name is Kyle Naback and I represent the United States in this appeal. I also served as trial counsel. This case involved a brutal rape of a six-year-old Native American female on the Okawinge Reservation in northern New Mexico. The perpetrator is non-Indian, and it happened on February 4th, 2018. The court should know that the injuries, which weren't mentioned by defense counsel, the injuries sustained by the child from this sexual assault left her writhing in pain at the hospital. So much pain that the child had to be sedated before her sexual assault exam could be conducted. The same nurse found multiple injuries to AW's genitalia that were consistent with rubbing, friction, and rough digital penetration. Her vagina was abraded and weeping. These were acute injuries, as testified to by the same nurse, Corinne Luna.
Counsel, just a clarification for me, because I did see in the record where at least the evidence from the defendant was that AW was not crying, was not upset when she left, when her mother was getting her ready to leave to take her to the hospital. She hugged him. It seems rather inconsistent with mother's testimony about what was happening in the vehicle and how upset she was and the statements that she made. Did the mother testify differently about what was happening as she was gathering her up and getting ready to go? Or did she concede that that's what was going on?
The defendant, Your Honor, was the only one who testified that the child appeared calm, gave him a hug, and called him Uncle Kevin. Now, in fact, the child, prior to this incident, did refer to him as Uncle Kevin, right, and she knew him well.
Yeah.
The mother did not testify to that. To the contrary, the mother testified, this is, Your Honor, in the Record of Appeal, Volume 3 at 407 and 425 and 24, 420, I'm sorry, 425 and 26. Consuelo testified that AW was scared, shocked, crying, and in pain. And the statement that this court is considering at trial came out as, "Mama, my cookie hurts and my butt hurts. Uncle Kevin put his fingers in my cookie and his pee-pee in my butt twice."
That was in the car. That was the statement. Right. This was what was happening in the car. And I guess my question was more specific. Did she counter and indicate what the child's disposition was like as they were getting ready to leave? That's all I was asking. I understand what happened in the car and what she said.
I'm sorry, Judge Moritz. I misunderstood.
Sorry.
The mom,
is there anything to counter that in the evidence?
Yes, there is. The mom testified that after she heard her child gasp in bed, after she felt the defendant's erect penis in his pants down, that she immediately took the child out of the house. She did not testify that there were, and she had, the defense had plenty of time to cross-examine her. She did not testify that she offered the child up to give hugs to Tabitha or to Kevin V. Hill, that they went out the door to the car. And that's the reason why I mentioned Consuelo's testimony, is that was the first thing she noticed about the child, was that she was in the car, shocked, scared, crying, and in pain, and then made the statement that I just referred to.
So the only two people who testified about what happened in the house were the mother and the defendant. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. There were two other witnesses.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
There were two other witnesses that passed away between the time of the event and the time of trial. So there were four people in the room.
Okay. Right. So when the mother testified, I assume in the government's case in chief,
that's true.
She said she testified the way you just described. She just said she heard the gasp. She saw the condition of the defendant and immediately grabbed the child and took her to the car. That's all she said. There was no mention of any hugging until she took the stand and said that. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Judge Hartz.
Okay. And she wasn't recalled as a witness to say, no, there was no hugging. She didn't testify on rebuttal then. The mother didn't.
She was not called in rebuttal by the government or by the defense.
Okay. Okay.
So
That's clarified in my mind now.
Thank you. After testifying in his own defense, the defendant said, I didn't touch her. I don't know how the DNA got there. He claimed on the witness stand that he didn't know how DNA works. But the jury found him guilty of aggravated sexual abuse with a child on count two, the digital penetration. And they did, in fact, acquit on count one, the anal penetration. Now, Mr. Fuchs would have you think that there has to be some type of full-blown penetration and that we didn't prove exactly when it happened. First of all, I don't think that's the standard. But if you look at 18 U.S.C. 2246, the statute that describes sexual acts, you will see that it can be the penetration, however slight, of the anus. And in fact, we did have the defendant's DNA both on her labia majora and her anus. There were other male DNA on those private parts as well. However, Mr. V. Hills, as testified by two DNA experts for the government, Mr. V. Hills' DNA was in there in much larger proportions than any other male DNA. So there's a couple of cases I wanted to point out. I wanted to start with the one you authored.
It's clear that the other male DNA was not from defendant. He could be excluded from that DNA, or was it just that they couldn't show that that DNA was from him?
I don't claim to be an expert. This new DNA is highly technical.
I don't want your opinion. I want what was testified to.
Yeah, right.
So
Kevin V. Hill's DNA was separate and distinct from any other DNA found on the child's private parts, both her anus and her labia majora, including her underwear. It's clear that Kevin V. Hill's DNA was there. There were other male DNA that was present in small proportions. That's the essence of the forensic examiner's testimony.
The examiner said, I can tell that that wasn't defendant's DNA, or the examiner said, I can't tell what male, who the male was. I can't identify that it was different from defendant. Was there anything about that?
Yes. The record is clear. There was extensive DNA testimony, and there is no question. They gave you I don't have the data at my fingertips, but there are proportions. And the defendant's DNA was separate and distinct from any other male DNA.
You're not responding to my question.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I'll try to be clear. There's no question. You said that there was testimony that the defendant's DNA was there in substantial quantities. I'm very curious about other male DNA being reported, being discovered there. And I want to know what, if possible, or if there was any testimony, did the expert say anything about whose DNA that other male DNA was? Did it say, I can't tell whether that was defendant's, or did the expert say that was not defendant's, but we don't know whose it was? Was there anything like that in the testimony?
Thank you, Your Honor, for clarifying. Your question seeks to identify other DNA for which we did not have exemplars. We did not have the experts testify about who is the person responsible for the other DNA that's found on the child's underwear.
Okay. I knew that. Did the expert exclude defendant as being the source of that other DNA?
No.
He did not exclude the defendant. So it could have been the defendant's DNA. There just wasn't sufficient sequence. There wasn't a sufficient genetic sequence there to determine whether it was defendant's. All they could tell is it came from that there was a Y chromosome. Is that
there
right?
There you go. You are correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Because it would be a different situation if there were samples of three or four people other than defendant. That would raise all sorts of questions about what's going on here.
Well, I would tend to agree with the court, although we were there for the sexual assault charges for Kevin Behill. We didn't concern and it's concerning, and obviously it probably was concerning to the jury, but we weren't there to prove that anyone else sexually assaulted the child or whether Kevin Behill had been intimate with another male and deposited on the child through his own penis. It was a bit of a, there was, again, there's a, the record has a lot of testimony about DNA. I'm happy to provide a 28J letter if the court wants me to go through that. But they were sufficiently cross-examined. And so I leave the court with that on this issue.
You had some numbers in your brief, as I recall. It might have been in a footnote. I'm not finding them quickly, but I thought you had some numbers in there about what the, you know, like a 90-1 chance that it was the defendant's DNA versus a something for the other DNA.
You're correct, Judge Morris. We did. That's why we put him in the brief, and I just don't have him at my fingertips right now. I don't know if the court is concerned about the contemporaneity argument that was not raised in the district court below, but is being raised for the first time on appeal. But the United States would submit that the child almost immediately, the court in its case law, particularly, says that heightened deference should be given to the court when they are making hearsay determinations and factual determinations. But the child, the court was not arbitrary, capricious, whimsical, or otherwise. We had 3 days of pretrial litigation. Judge Vasquez heard from both the defendant and from Consuelo Ward. We got to cross-examine the defendant. The Consuelo was examined about her reliability and all the other statements that Mr. Fuchs just raised. And ultimately, the court issued in document 188, a very contemplative, comprehensive opinion that these were reliable statements, both under 803.1 and 803.2. And this court has also said that there is no hard line rule for, and this is in United States versus Lovato. This court, like other courts, have refused to adopt a per se or a bright line rule describing how much time can pass between an event and a statement describing the event before this statement is no longer admissible.
Do we distinguish between present sense and impression and excited utterance in that regard? I'm confident we don't have a bright line rule with respect to excited utterance. But the rule for present sense impression is at the time or immediately thereafter, I think, in the rule.
That's right. Judge, the cases that I've reviewed look like, for present sense impression, they are a tighter time frame than excited utterances. But under either standard, we think Judge Vasquez did not act in an arbitrary or capricious manner. And I think the reason is she heard live testimony that there was no significant gap in time between the sexual assault and the statements that the child made. Maybe as little as 20 minutes, maybe shorter than that.
I don't think the way I understand counsel's argument in the brief and today is that he's not necessarily suggesting that that was a problem there. He's not saying that if that is truly when the event occurred, when the assault occurred, that this was too far removed, the statements. I think what he's saying is there was no finding or no evidence presented that as to when the event really happened. He's suggesting it simply could not have happened in the 3-minute time period while Consuela was laying there in bed, apparently awake, that she said it did, if that makes any sense.
It does, Your Honor.
So I don't see the challenge to be to the time that occurred, you know, once they got out of bed and she gets in the car. It's more about whether the facts were there to establish the timing of the actual assault.
And I see my time is almost up. Can I answer your question?
Please respond to the question.
So a number of things. In their brief, the defendant cites common knowledge as this being too short of a time to be sexually assaulted. There was no expert that testified that there needs to be more than a minute or more than 2 minutes, or it has to be a 15 minute period of time in a bed with a child to sexually assault him. I think that's counterintuitive. And I don't know that the government has to prove the exact timing. I don't think that's our burden, the exact timing of things. But if that child slept for hours in the bed with Kevin V. Hill and was in there for a period of 5, 10, or 15 minutes, I would suggest to the court that it not adopt some rule that there has to be a period of time. As someone who's been prosecuting these cases for 18 years, sexual assaults of children can happen in a 30-second period, in a 5-minute period. So for the defense to suggest that this couldn't possibly have happened after the mother hears her child gasp, after feels the defendant's erect penis. And I hope the court doesn't believe that the defendant might not have done this while the mother was present. He may not have known there was drinking going on. He may not have known the mother was in bed. He may not have known whether she was awake or asleep. And I don't think the court should delineate how much time it takes to sexually assault a child. Thank you for that question, Judge Moritz. My time has concluded.
Any additional questions?
No.
All right, counsel, thank you. Your time expired. The case is submitted and counsel are excused. We appreciate the good arguments this morning.